So today is a question box Sunday where I'm going to try my best to answer your questions that you've submitted. I probably won't get to all of them. I won't have time, but I'll do my best. And if I can, then maybe later in the year, I'll address some of the other questions in a scroll article, which is our weekly newsletter, or in another sermon. So the first few are easy. They're warm-up questions. What is your favorite food? My favorite food. It changes. Right now, sushi. I love sushi, especially spicy sushi. Music is constantly playing in our house. What music or musicians are favorites in your home? We always love the Beatles, and right now, really into Lizzo. If you don't know Lizzo, you should. Awesome feminist, body positive, black, awesome woman singer, rapper. If you had one superpower, what would it be? Probably breathing underwater. Like, can Aquaman breathe underwater? I don't know. I didn't see the movie. I'm not that into comics. I don't want gills because that would be weird. But I just want the ability to breathe underwater because I love, when I was a kid, I used to sit at the bottom of the pool and just marvel at the lack of gravity and how quiet it is under there. Are you going to dance a cabaret this year? Probably not, Mary. Maybe, I don't know. I don't want to rule it out. There's always a possibility. I love to dance, but my favorite kind of dancing is just sort of impromptu dancing. So if somebody is singing a really fabulous song, maybe I'll stand where I am and dance and we can all join in together. This is a sort of a technical question, and I have a very quick answer for it. How do you dedicate a child here at the UU Fellowship? We have dedications scheduled about 4 or 5 times a year. We publish those in our scroll and also in our RE wing. And we ask that you sign up about a month in advance of those. Just email either me or Leah, and we will send you some questions so that we can make that experience personal for you and your family. But we might dedicate one child if only one family signs up, or if 3 or 4 families show up and there's 2 or 3 kids in one family, we might have a whole bunch of kids to dedicate on the same Sunday. Both possibilities are wonderful. If you ever have any questions like that, how does something happen here at the fellowship, don't ever hesitate to ask me, Leah, Marie, Kim, our religious education coordinator. We're always happy to answer those questions for you. All right, now we're getting into the meat of it all, the tofu of it all. I'm struggling with everyone's inherent worth and dignity. Some people, it's hard to notice or see their inherent worth and dignity. So our first Unitarian principle says we affirm and promote the fact that everyone has inherent worth and dignity. What does that even mean? It comes from our universalist ancestors. Remember, we were 2, Unitarian and Universalist, we were 2 separate Christian denominations for hundreds of years until the 1960s when we merged together and created this new thing that was no longer explicitly Christian. But we took with us some of our heritage. And the Universalist heritage was that God wouldn't damn anyone to hell, that no one would go to hell, that everyone was loved by God, even people who didn't believe in God, even people who didn't believe in Jesus, even people who did terrible, terrible things wouldn't go to hell. So that is where we kind of take our belief that everyone has worth, everyone has something inside them that is worthy of love and dignity. That does not mean everyone is a good person, that everyone's behavior is acceptable, that anything goes. That is not what that first principle means. So I've had people say to me, when I've had to set boundaries around behavior, but what about our first principle? Not every behavior has worth. Every human has worth. So if you're struggling looking at people, particularly people in our public sphere, and you're looking at them going, I can't imagine that they have any worth at all, their behaviors might not. And some people don't believe in their own worth and dignity, and so then they act in ways that's harmful to others. The more we can believe in it, the more we can treat other people as if they have it, the more they will start to claim it themselves too. Now, granted, we don't have any control over public famous people, but it helps us to let go of the idea that they are terrible, horrible monsters. We don't believe that any human being is a monster. We don't use language like that. Those are othering words that harm not only the other person, but they harm us. They belittle us and our ability to see them as humans. So I did a sermon a while back where I said, the first principle is the one that requires the most faith. Faith is belief in something that can't be seen. And sometimes we just can't see it. We just have to believe in it. So I encourage you to just practice that as a spiritual practice, to hold those people that you're like, man, I don't like them. Hold them in your heart. My trick is to remember that they were once a baby. So hearing Nova babble over there, these people that you're really mad at right now were once a tiny baby like Nova babbling in church. And that helps me. Who should attend your session on white fragility? Brian Looker, who's sitting back there, and I are going to be hosting a session at the end of September. Is it the 24th? September 24th, a two-hour session on whiteness. We're calling it White People's Work. So if you identify as white, we encourage you to come to this session. You don't have to, but if you would like to read in advance the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, we're going to have some copies in our bookstore and in our lending library to borrow. So who should come? Anybody who identifies as white should come, especially if when you hear things like the words white fragility or racism or white supremacy culture or Black Lives Matter, if you get like this little itchy feeling inside, like, ooh, why does she have to use those words? Then you're a perfect person to come to this session. Because we're going to just kind of talk about and get that stuff, wiggle that stuff out of our bodies. Because here's the thing, friends. White folks, all of us, have been socialized in a culture of whiteness. It's just the norm. I'm not saying it's inherently bad. I'm just saying it's the norm. Whiteness is our norm. And if we were brought up as white people, then we have sort of internalized these messages as normative, as normal. And then when someone else says to us, you know, this behavior or that behavior is racist, we're like, oh, how dare you, right? We get really angry. We don't need to feel angry or hurt. We can just say, oh, thanks for sharing that was hurtful to you or something like that. We can start to unlearn the behaviors that were taught to us by our culture. And that's what we're going to do in this class. And Brian has been a facilitator of our Beloved Conversations for 2 years and is really good at this work. And also, Brian is bringing a lens, which I'm really excited about, of spirituality, of seeing this as a spiritual practice. This isn't just a social justice issue. This is an issue of our own spirits, our own hearts being right in the world. And I think it's going to be a really cool class. So come. On that note, what has been your biggest joy or challenge as the mom of children whose ethnicity differs from your own? You can see why I put these two questions together. I have two adopted boys who are both biracial. They're both, their biological parents are half, one was white and one was black. So both my children present to the world as black or brown, and I don't. I'm white. And I also don't have the learning. I didn't grow up in a family, or I wasn't treated by the world as a person of color because I'm white and I identify as white and I present to the world as white. So I don't know what it's like to be inside their bodies in a white world. But I can do my very best to try to unlearn the things that I was taught as a white person to try to put myself with some empathy into their experience and share with them the beautiful good parts of their ethnicity and also the hard parts, the ways that the world is going to treat them unfairly because of their ethnicity. One thing that I've learned as a parent of children of color is that parents of children of color don't shelter their children from race or racism. White parents do that. And we have to be, as white parents of children of color, we have to be really careful not to do that. We have to be really careful to talk to them about their race, talk to them about who they are, about the fact that it's a good whole part of their identity. We have to talk to them as they get older about the things that are going to be challenging about their race, living in a world of whiteness. We have to be careful when they learn how to drive. We're going to have two boys, brown boys, that they know how to be respectful of the police. These are talks that black parents have with their children, and I'm having to learn quick how to do that as a white parent. So those are some of the joys and challenges. I just think my boys are incredibly beautiful. I love everything about them. And one thing I've learned is that white folks also have been taught that color blindness is good, that it's good to not see color. And I don't want people to not see the color of my children. I want people to see all of them, that their ethnicity is a part of who they are and it's a good part of who they are. What is the role of forgiveness in Unitarian Universalism? Unitarian Universalism, in part because of our history that I just talked about, our universalist history, has a hard time talking about evil, sin, bad stuff. We tend to be an overly optimistic faith. There's an old saying, I want to say it was in Unitarianism back in the 1800s, they used to recite this creed that they believe in the, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was something like, we believe in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Christ, and something, 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 onward and upward forever was the end of the creed that everyone would say in the old Unitarian churches. Onward and upward forever. Like, we're just going to get better and better as humanity. And then World War I and then World War II hit, and they stopped saying that. Because it was like, oh, maybe not. Maybe we're not just getting better and better. Maybe we do terrible things to each other. So, but we've forgotten how to honor the hard things. We've forgotten how to lament, how to be sad, how to be angry, how to sit with that instead of just saying, well, I'm really sad, but I got to go do something about it. I got to go fight or do something else. And therefore, we also don't talk a lot about forgiveness. And I don't know, so I'm saying all that to say we don't have a theology of forgiveness, a unified theology of forgiveness as Unitarian Universalists, but what I would say is that forgiveness is not about the other person. It's not about the action that was done to you. It is about you and how you are holding whatever's happened to you. So if you're saying, I don't know how to forgive this person who harmed me, I'm just holding on to it, and I can't forgive them because they are terrible people. I would say it's not about them. It's about you and what you're holding on to, and the fact that carrying around that anger, that grudge, that sadness is harming you. It's not harming the other person. So they say that holding on to a grudge is like drinking poison and hoping it hurts the other person. Forgiveness is refusing to drink the poison. Forgiveness is setting the poison down and saying, I'm not having anything to do with that anymore. So that's not a uniquely Unitarian Universalist perspective, but I think it's a helpful one. If you are still in relationship with a person who has harmed you, then it's up to you if you want to pass that on to the other person. If you want to say, I'm letting this go, I'm not letting it harm me anymore, you can do that. You don't have to. If you're still in an ongoing relationship with a person who's harmed you, then I invite you to consider whether that relationship is healthy for you. If you need help thinking about that, if you want to come talk to me in my office or Leah, Reverend Leah, or one of our pastoral care providers about, do I want to still be in this ongoing relationship with someone who's harmed me, then we can help you with that. But I would say if it's a repeated harm, abuse or something like that, then it's not an issue of forgiveness until you've provided yourself safety. Then once you're in a safe place, then we can talk about forgiveness, about letting go for your own heart's sake. But first, think about safety. And come talk to me if you need to do that. All right, this is a long one. If we at least were to become full members here from being UCC, United Church of Christ, we have many, if not all, of the same heart for having our own journeys, but adherent to Christ, what would be that deciding factor in your opinion? So the question is, if we're deciding between being UCC or UU, what's the deciding factor? And you all know I'm a history geek, that I love history. So the Unitarians and the Congregationalists, who are the bulk of the UCC church, used to be the same thing. And in the mid-1800s, the Congregationalists and the Unitarians split over an issue of theology, over whether or not God was a unity, one being, that was us, the Unitarians, or a trinity, three beings, that was the Congregationalists. So we split in the mid-1800s, and then we kind of went on our journeys, but we sort of stayed really close to each other, kind of parallel. Then the Unitarians merged with the Universalists, and that's who we are today. And the UCCs merged with some other folks, I can't remember who, and they became the United Church of Christ, the Congregationalists. But we joke, and UCCs joke too, that UCC stands for Unitarians Considering Christ, because we're really close together. We're really similar in a lot of ways. They're very liberal, very left-leaning theologically. They ordain women. They ordain LGBTQ folks. They have a very this worldly faith, living their faith in the world. They are Christian, though. They believe that Jesus is a unique path to God, and Unitarian Universalists don't believe that. We believe that Jesus could be one of the paths to God, but is not the only path to God. And so if the deciding factor is, do you need regular worship of Jesus and God to fill your heart and spirit? And if so, I would recommend the UCCs, because we're not going to do that a lot here. We do talk about Jesus. I talk about God. There's a few Sundays a year that we really focus, particularly Easter, Christmas, but we're not going to do that every Sunday. If having a more broad approach to many paths, many inspirational paths to what some people call God, is for you, then I think you should be here. So I'm in good relationship with our UCC pastors over at First Congo. We get along really well. They were here when I was installed as a senior minister. There's no harm to be done over there. They're wonderful people. So are we. I wish you the best in making your decision. I also want people to know, you know, sometimes people are like, I just really, really need, you know, on Christmas Eve to hear the whole biblical story of Jesus's birth. Great. I recommend you go to another congregation for that. I will touch on Jesus. We'll do a little Jesus. But it might not be what you need. And I just want you to get what you need. You're not cheating on the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. If you go somewhere else one Sunday, that's fine. What are your thoughts regarding past lives? Do you believe there is truth to reincarnation? I have no idea. I told you I don't know all the answers. That's one of those that I get to wonder about. I think some people have had personal experience that has led them to believe that they've had past lives, that they've remembered things from past lives, things like that. I haven't had those experiences, so it would be disingenuous for me to say that I believe it fully. I also haven't had experiences that have told me that that's not possible, so I'm open on the issue. If you have had those experiences and you believe in past lives, I think that's a perfectly valid belief. I always say I'm a theological pragmatist. If it works for you, believe it. If it doesn't work for you, if your belief system is harming you, or it's making you afraid, or making you scared of other people, something like that, then don't believe it anymore. It's a bad belief. Your belief systems should help you. They should help you in the world. They should help you navigate the world. And if you need help letting go of harmful beliefs, then let's talk. All right, I have time for one last one. Oh, so hard. There's so many good questions. What changes would you like to see the fellowship make moving forward? We're doing really good work together, friends. I think one of the biggest anxieties of coming to a new congregation as a minister is whether the congregation is going to be ready to do the work with you. And I came here 2 years ago, not sure. I thought you were ready, but I wasn't sure. And in the last 2 years, we've done really cool work together. And I'm proud of that, not just for myself, but for you and for the work we've created together here and in the community. I think we can always move forward. There's nothing huge, glaring, terribly wrong. But a couple of the things that we're working on are stewardship. Our annual stewardship campaign, where we ask you to make a promise of how much money you're able to give for the coming year, has been a real challenge. Just getting people to even turn in the form that says, yes, I can give, or no, I can't, or whatever, that's even been hard. So we're working on that. Our governing board is bringing in a consultant to help us work with that this December, and you're going to hear a lot more about that from him. He's going to help us figure out how we can improve that for our congregation. Because if we're not financially stable, then this whole thing won't exist. We can't have a building, we can't have lights, we can't have coffee, we can't have paid staff. So talking about money, just getting better about talking about it, that it's not a terrible, sinful, ugly thing, it's just a thing in the world that we need to start getting better about talking about. So stewardship is one. And I would say our justice work. We say in our mission statement, one-third of our mission is that we lead in social justice. Like, that's a third of our goal, that we exist to lead in social justice. And I would say a large portion of our membership, you all, I'm looking out at you, do justice work in the community. You're at the rally. You're writing to your congresspeople. You're serving on committees and boards and doing great work in the world. But as an institution, as a fellowship, we're not that good about like getting all together to do stuff together or to have a common mission. We have a lot of little projects here and there and all over. And that's great, but it kind of waters down our goal. So thinking about how we're going to do that. We have our Justice Action Ministry teams and our Justice Action Ministry facilitators who are just really committed to getting you all involved in the good work that we're doing in the community. And I hear every month when we meet, nobody signed up to bring food to the shelter, or nobody is going to come to this thing. And they're putting it in the scroll. We have a whole separate justice email that goes out. I don't really know what the answer is to that question, but it's one thing I want to see us get better at. So we're going to keep working together, and I'm not going anywhere, I hope. Please. And I just really love being here. I love working with you all, and I feel really lucky. So thank you. With that, let's just take a moment to think about what we've heard, and think about if you have anything that you're going to share when it's time for our congregational response.